Deputy Mitchell is now in session. The Honorable Justice Raymond W. Mitchell is presiding.
Hey, morning folks, please be seated. So our case this morning is Payne versus PNC Bank. We've reviewed your briefing and the record in the case. You can certainly take that into account. We ordinarily allocate 20 minutes aside with 5 minutes for rebuttal for the appellate. I know we have a couple folks on the defense side. Have you thought about how you want to divide your argument?
We have not. The plan is that we're going to split evenly myself, counsel, and PNC as part of the machine on behalf of the appraisers.
Okay, so you're going to take your 20 minutes and go 10 minutes each, is that?
If that's acceptable.
Great. Okay. With that, we'll get started and could have counsel for the appellant. If you could step up and be sure to identify yourself.
Good morning. My name is Terry Blanchard. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Tina and William Payne. Okay. I'm sure that you've read everything that was submitted regarding the facts of this case, and I just wanted to go over a few points that we think it's critical for you to consider. In 2004, the Paynes sought to renovate their home. They had two options at the time. One was to add a second floor, and the other one was just to add rooms to the first floor. Based on Defendant Lavelle and Shiro's appraised value of the home being $1.8 million, with the renovations of adding the second floor, the Paynes had the second floor added, and PNC approved the loan to them in the amount of $1.4 million to carry out the renovations. The Paynes had been given
a copy. Do you recall, what was the collateral that was pledged for the loan? Was it simply a mortgage on the house, or was there other collateral?
That was the only collateral. Okay. That was the home. And the issue is there was the value of the home was never $1.8 million. So they were always going to be underwater with this mortgage.
Do we know what the value should have been in going back to that time period? What should the house have been appraised at? With the second floor addition, this is the appraiser's opinion of what it would be when the second floor was done. What should it have been valued at back then?
I think we can figure that out with forensic appraisals. We can go back and see what the appraised value was.
It's just other opinions, right?
No, it's not just an opinion. We don't think it's an opinion. And I think what's critical is the question is, are we willing to hold appraisers and banks liable when they don't follow established regulations and guidelines?
That sounds like negligence, right? That sounds like professional negligence, appraisal malpractice, not fraud.
Well, we think it's fraud, and we think we've...
So is it your position, and if it is, where are the complaint? Does it allege that the appraisers knew that the appraisals were false?
We allege that they did not follow USPA guidelines. And let me tell you what that is. So in this case, we allege that the appraisals failed to comply with USPAP guidelines. USPAP stands for Uniform Standards of Professional...
Let me just interrupt there. But to have a fraud claim,
right,
you have to make a knowing mistake. There's an element of scienter, right?
Right.
So the appraisers could be negligent. They could violate certain standards. And that could be, I suppose, circumstantial proof that they knew that are you alleging that they knew that the appraisals were false at the time that they made them?
They knew, or they should have known, because they didn't follow the guidelines.
Okay.
And if you, I was not aware of USPAP guidelines, and I've bought homes. But in this case, I just wanted to let you know what the USPAP is. It's a set of ethical and performance standards for the appraisal profession in the United States. It was developed and copyrighted by the Appraisal Foundation in 1987 and adopted by Congress in 1989. USPAP applies to all types of appraisal services, including real estate, personal property, business, and mass appraisals. And the purpose of the USPAP guidelines is to ensure the reliability and credibility of appraisals.
Okay, but so is that what you're saying, that they learned in 2017 was that the guidelines weren't followed in 2004 and 2005 when these appraisals were put together?
That's what we're saying.
So when they met with the new appraiser, whose name, I'm sorry, has escaped me, in 2017, that's when they learned, oh, these appraisals did not follow the guidelines.
Exactly. That's what we're saying. And we're saying that the guidelines are there to ensure the reliability and credibility. They're there to protect the public. They're there to protect the consumer. So in this case, we allege that
but you don't even have and you would agree that there's no negligence claim against the appraisers. They don't have a duty to you that gives rise to a negligence claim. I understand you have one against the bank.
Correct.
You have no negligence claim against them. Correct?
Correct. That's
and you couldn't.
Right.
I think we all agree with that.
Right. We do agree with that. We do have a negligence claim against PNC. So in this case, we allege that the appraisals violated USP guidelines and that the comparator properties were farther away than they should have been and that the sales that they used were older than they should have been. And this case is unusual because usually the appraisal falls short and the homeowner does not get the loan. Usually the bank wants to ensure that there's adequate collateral. But that's not always the case. In Gowdy versus Countrywide Home Loans, the bank made that same argument that the plaintiff's claims of appraisal fraud made no sense because the bank had no incentive to inflate the appraised value of the plaintiff's property. However, the court in Gowdy stated, putting appraisals completely in the hands of lenders may sound like a good idea because it is supposed to be the lenders who are putting their money at risk in a home loan.
Can I just ask you about paragraph 69 of your complaint?
Sure.
You allege defendants knew that the appraised value was inflated and false. What fact? That's a legal conclusion, right? That seems to comport with an element that's required to state a fraud claim. But what fact do you have as to scienter?
That they didn't follow the guidelines. They are making up comparator properties. We have guidelines that they're supposed to follow. They're not following the guidelines. And if they followed the guidelines, they would know that the house was never worth $1.8 million. And I do want to point out that sometimes a homeowner wants to make additions to the house in excess of the value, appraised value. For example, I worked for a firm where there were lottery winners in Roseland. They won the lottery, they wanted to do improvements of their home, but they knew and understood that even though they made millions of dollars worth of improvements, the value of their home wasn't going to change significantly. And they knew that, and the appraised value came in at what it was, it wasn't inflated. This is different.
Okay, in paragraph 77, you allege, defendants agreed upon a minimum value or range of value in advance of the appraisals being performed. So what fact, I guess that's a fact, but could you speak a little bit about that? Defendants agreed upon a minimum, were they in a room together?
So that's PNC and Shiro.
And Shiro, right. Now, this goes to the conspiracy to commit fraud. Are we in the room with them? No. And I believe the courts do say that we can plead on information and belief. But the thing is, We have two different appraisals coming in at $1.8 million. What are the odds that you're going to get two appraisals for the exact same amount of money? And so we can draw inferences that how do, and this rarely happens that an appraiser would come in at the exact same amount of the loan that you loan amount that is needed. So we can draw inferences, Your Honors, that this is what happened.
Well,
unless...
Go ahead.
That wasn't the loan amount originally. I mean, they originally got a lower loan amount, and later they upped it.
Based on the appraised value of the home being $1.8 million with the renovations.
Well, two appraisers might come in at $1.8 million if they were collusive. Or two appraisals might actually come in at $1.8 million because that actually would reflect the market at the time.
Well, we're saying that that home is never appraised for anywhere near that. Even as late as spring of 2022, the appraised value of the home was $870,000.
Well, but 2022, we're in a different world.
Right.
Post, let's say, 07, 08, everyone's home is in a different value. How can we say what it's being appraised at in 22 reflects that in 04, 05, there was a fraud?
As I've said before, we can bring in forensic appraisals to show what were the comparators, what should the home have appraised for, and we've alleged that. We've alleged that.
So Sherwin LaValle give an opinion and say, this is what it's going to be worth when these second floor renovations, there's renovations of different styles, but the second floor renovations, if you do this second story renovation, it'll be worth $1.8 million. That's what we believe it's going to be worth.
But it's more than an opinion. And we believe that it's more than an opinion because courts have held that appraisals can be the basis of liability, and we cite...
Sure, because appraisers are in the business of giving opinions, and if they give a knowingly false opinion, it's actionable.
And that's what we're saying, because they didn't follow the guidelines. And at this point, we're just trying to establish a cause of action.
Right, that's what discovery's for.
Right, and we are asking to be able to do that. This purchase, and for any homeowner, represents the single most valuable thing that they will ever invest in. And for PNC to say, because the plaintiff is a doctor and is not really concerned about the actual value of the home, does a real disservice to them. And we know from discovery taken from the earlier federal case that this was their consideration. They knew, PNC knew at the time, that there was an issue with the home providing adequate collateral for the loan. But they went ahead and said, oh, we'll approve it because he can make the payments.
Well, is there some specific fact that you learned in the federal case that can you be more specific and point us to where it is in your complaint?
We allege this. We allege that the plaintiffs have pled and that defendants took affirmative steps to hide the fraud.
I mean, I guess there's three different possibilities. One is the home really was worth that. Two is it wasn't, but there was no knowing fraud in appraising it at that. And the third, and what your, I think, complaint rises and falls on, is they knowingly put out a number that they knew was wrong.
That's what we're alleging. We state that the defendants did not disclose that PNC did not believe that the home provided sufficient collateral. That is from the discovery.
So there's something in the that you learned in the discovery that's not specifically alleged in your complaint that said PNC knew, was concerned, had expressed concern this collateral might not be sufficient. Is that what you're saying?
Right, we do say that in the complaint.
I guess I'm puzzled if that really gives rise to an inference of fraud. A lender obviously is going to scrutinize a transaction with someone like me with a very modest income versus someone with a larger income, right?
Well,
we know this from the Donald Trump case in New York, that the Deutsche Bank would lend Trump whatever he wanted because he was a good bet for them, business bet.
Well, we're saying that the appraisals should have been accurate, like the Roseland case, like our case with the people in Roseland who won the lottery. Just be accurate with the appraisal so the homeowner knows what they're getting into.
But they're accurate to the extent that they can say, well, you're proposing this second floor addition. If you do this second floor addition, this is what we estimate the value of the house would be. Not the value of the house as positioned now prior to the addition.
Right.
It's post-addition.
Right, and we're saying that even post-addition, that the value of that house was never $1.8 million. They've always been underwater.
Isn't that a risk that the homeowner takes? Like your Roseland example. If you want to overimprove your property, that's a risk that you take. The bank's not there to say, I think you really shouldn't put in the high-end appliances.
But with the Roseland example, the appraisals were always accurate, so the homeowners knew what the value of their home was. In this case, the appraisers and the banks said the value of the home was 1.8. It was never 1.8.
And they didn't know this. Part of your complaint is that they didn't know this until 2017.
Correct.
When they meet with...
2018. Well, I believe it's January of 2018.
So there's an open question, right? Is it 2017? Is it 2018? Or there's discussion about that they're trying to refinance as early as 2010.
Right. Right. Immediately after, or some time after, they're immediately trying to refinance.
Which is to say, then they know this value isn't there.
Well, I think that's an issue of fact as to when you know that there is an issue.
Okay.
We're saying that they were never given any written indication, and we believe that this is similar to what the court held in Smith versus Cook County Hospital. So in June of 2022...
Hold on. When you say no written indication, what does no written indication mean?
They never put in writing that the home did not provide adequate collateral.
But the paragraph 37 says... Plaintiffs are given a copy of defendant's appraisal. Defendant Lavelle's appraisal and believe the value of the home would be $1.8 million with improvements.
Right.
So they were given some writing.
They were never given a writing that explained the reason why the bank declined to refinance the property.
Right.
Oh,
they were never told that they were underwater. They were never told that the appraisals didn't comply with USPAP standards, that the comparator properties that the appraisals used were inadequate because of the time and the distance used. And in June of 2022, the plaintiffs had a conversation with PNC because they're constantly trying to refinance. The bank says, we're going to put in writing what happened. They never do that, but they do say, your home doesn't provide sufficient collateral for the loan, that's why we can't refinance. And what we're saying is because they had never put that into writing, that the PNC Bank withheld that information, and they should have provided that information like they said they were going to provide it in June of 2022. And this is similar to what the court found in Smith versus Cook County Hospital, where the failure to provide information could be evidence of fraudulent concealment. So we're saying that the bank should have told them that your home doesn't provide sufficient collateral.
Should have told them that in 2022 their home did not.
Well, they should have told them, well, they never should have told them that their home valued at $1.8 million based on these appraisals. They never should have done that.
Right.
But what we're saying is that we know that they could have put it in writing because they offered to do that in June of 2022. They didn't do that, but they did tell them, your home doesn't provide sufficient collateral. That's the issue. But they, so that was the first time we knew that the bank admitted that there was insufficient collateral for the home loan, and that's why they couldn't refinance the home. So we believe that we have sufficiently pled a cause of action for common law fraud, deception under the Illinois Commercial Deceptive Practice Act, and
conspiracy and negligence.
And conspiracy and negligence. I'm not sure where I am.
Well, before you run out of time, let me ask you about two other things. First, you did not ask to replead. I think it's a little unclear. The trial court seems to have thought that she dismissed it with prejudice, I think. And you don't, do you have any objection to that, or do you believe that you should have been allowed to replead?
Well, we believe our due process rights were violated when Judge Catherine Schneider abruptly dismissed plaintiff's complaint with prejudice without plaintiff's knowledge that she had been reassigned to the case.
But getting past the fact that it's Judge Schneider that was assigned to it, the question is, you didn't ask to file an amended complaint.
Well, by that time, it had already been dismissed with prejudice.
Okay.
And by operation of the rule for substitution of judge, we couldn't.
I understand the question differently. Is that
okay.
Separate from the substitution question.
Okay.
You're not complaining on appeal, the complaint shouldn't have been. You're defending the adequacy of the complaint that you filed. You're not saying, we should have been given a chance to cure these supposed defects.
Well, we would have taken an opportunity to cure the alleged defects had we been given an opportunity to.
But as you stand here now, there are no more facts. You are unaware of any more facts you could possibly have pled. You pled everything you could, right, in the complaint that you filed.
I believe so. But we do believe that our due process rights were violated. And
okay, well, with regard to that, when a judge is assigned to a new calendar, there's an order that's published. It's published typically in the law bulletin, assigning a judge to a particular calendar, and there would be a docket entry. So, but you don't suggest that there was never a docket entry indicating that Judge Schneider took over.
I have reviewed the record on appeal. I am not aware of an order.
Not an order to you, but a general publication, either in the law bulletin or how, you know, if you go to the website.
Sure, that's right. The website, and it's put in the law bulletin as well, right? A new judge is assigned to a calendar.
Okay.
They weren't hiding Judge Schneider from you. You just never got it. Your argument is that you didn't get a specific notice saying, hey, parties, in this case, there's a new judge assigned to this
case. And
county.
You should never replace a Snyder with a Schneider.
Right. So, no, we did not get notification. And the first time that we got notification was the dismissal of the case with prejudice.
So you get that dismissal. Did you then go in on a motion and say, hey, wait a minute, we never knew. We were never given notice that we had a new judge. Had we been given notice, we would have exercised our right to take a change.
By operation of the rule, and the rule is if the judge has made a substantive ruling, then you can't file your motion for SOJ. So by operation of that rule, we were prevented from doing so. That was our interpretation of what the rule is. So at that point, we file our appeal, basically. But we believe that that is a substantial right, the right to SOJ.
What would the remedy be at this point for us to do if we agreed with you?
We believe it should be remanded.
And assigned to a different judge?
Assigned to a judge. Well, we should be given a right to exercise our SOJ right. And we should have a right to have a judge hear the case.
But how is her ruling any less of a substantive ruling? I mean, you correctly say the rule says you have to bring a motion before there's a substantive ruling. And that's why you didn't bring a motion to reconsider. Okay, well then that ship has sailed, right? We can't unring the bell. So we're on appeal.
Well,
she still made a substantive ruling before you interposed any motion for substitution. Kind of.
Well, I think the remedy is to remand and allow us to exercise our right to SOJ. It is a substantive right, and we were prevented from doing so in this case.
And allow you to amend the complaint or proceed on the complaint as filed?
Well, we would ask to amend, but I don't know if we would amend the complaint, but it certainly is an issue that we were not allowed to exercise our right to SOJ. And I think we should be allowed to remand. We can't obviously do it with Judge Catherine H. Schneider because she has already made a substantive ruling. And so,
but so,
so, so
we remand back to the courts, not all the time, but we remand back to the courts and direct a judge to reconsider their earlier ruling. That's not to say that if we remand it back, it can't go back to that judge, right?
I guess that's possible, but in this case, we're saying that our substantive right for SOJ was violated.
Well, doesn't that necessarily means that we must agree with you on the first point? That is to say, that you state a viable cause of action, doesn't it?
Well, that's correct, and we believe we have stated a viable cause of action.
Well, okay, so if you're right on that, then you get a remand anyway. So there's really no prejudice from the failure to exercise the SOJ.
Well, I'm not sure how you're going to rule, but we would say that we have established a cause of action for fraud. We feel that we have alleged that the defendants took affirmative acts to conceal what the fraud was. We've alleged that defendants did not give the Shiro appraisal to plaintiffs. We've alleged that defendants did not tell the plaintiffs that the appraisals were incorrect. We've alleged that defendants did not tell the plaintiffs that the appraisals were not done in accordance with the USPAP guidelines and standards. We've alleged that defendants did not disclose that PNC did not believe that the home provided sufficient collateral back when the loan was given. We've alleged that in approximately June of 2022, that plaintiffs had a conversation with PNC in which PNC said it would send a letter explaining why it was rejecting their latest request to refinance the loan.
And so somehow that the value of the house in 22 is not 1.8 million. That translates back to that the value of the house wasn't 1.8 in 05.
For us, this all goes back to them violating the USPAP's guidelines. And we can show.
But an appraisal in 22 has nothing to do with an appraisal from however many years, and
right.
15 years earlier.
But we can show that back when the loan was given, they didn't follow the guidelines, because we can look at the comparator properties. We know that what was done wrong. So we can say without a shadow of a doubt that the comparator properties used to justify that $1.8 million, those properties were taken, were a lot farther away than they should have been. One property was in Frankfurt, which is a much different location than Flossmoor. And we know that they used sales that were older than they should have used. So we can tell that they were just basically trying to come up with this number, and it didn't adequately reflect what was going on in that community and how much that property was worth. And I believe that we have alleged that. And I'm saying that we have alleged that they withheld information and they should have provided this information, much like my example in Roseland, where the people are told your property isn't going to be worth more even though you put millions of dollars into it. If that was what they wanted to do, they could have just said your property isn't going to be worth $1.8 million, and they would have gone with the different renovation of just adding rooms to the first floor. And that's why we know that there should be liability. We should be allowed at least to attempt to move forward with this litigation and get justice for these people who have been in a state of being underwater on a mortgage and they can't refinance and they really have no other option.
Okay. With that, we'll hear from your friends on the other side, and then we'll hear from your rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Toby Schisler with Dinsmore & Scholl, counsel for PNC Bank. As we mentioned at the beginning, our plan is to divide roughly equally the time to myself and my colleagues. Ms. Bartolucci is primarily going to focus on the due process, substitution of judge issue, and just for efficiency purposes, I'm going to primarily focus on the merits and the substantive issues of the case being insufficiently pled. That said, we're both certainly happy to answer questions as they relate to our clients involving any of the issues. The appellees respectfully contend that the trial court properly granted the motions to dismiss and issued a thorough, well-reasoned decision finding that the claim is
well-reasoned. It was one paragraph of analysis. 11.5 pages of summary, book report summary.
Fair enough. A correct decision that only reached the correct conclusion after thoroughly summarizing the briefing from the parties in the pertinent issues that were raised in the case. The trial court correctly recognized that even though the appellants had been given multiple opportunities to amend their complaint, that they had still failed to set forth facts.
They only amended once, correct?
They amended in state court once. They had also previously filed a largely identical action in federal court.
Okay.
The federal claims were dismissed on the merits. The federal court declined to exercise jurisdiction
right.
over the remaining
sure,
claims.
Kind of counting that federal court one as a first.
Opportunity to plead. That's correct. They've had multiple opportunities.
The trial court never did, as one commercial calendar judge was praised for doing by the appellate court. That was me. They never said.
Did you praise yourself?
No, once. In an abundance of caution, we're going to give you one final opportunity to replead. There was never a warning to the plaintiff that this is it. Right?
That there is no explicit warning. To the best of my knowledge, it was not communicated at either orally or in writing that there would be no further opportunities to amend.
Let me ask you about a troubling allegation. Defendants agreed, so this is all the defendants, upon a minimum value or range of value in advance of the appraisals being performed. And PNC approved the loan knowing that the probable actual value of the home was well below $1.8 million. That's a factual allegation. And now I understand that you disagree with that fact, but
How do you not have to accept that fact for purposes of a motion to dismiss?
Yes, certainly, Your Honor. If we take that as a factual allegation as opposed to a legal conclusion.
As opposed to what?
As opposed to a conclusory legal conclusion. If we treat it as a factual allegation, that fact still has to be read in the context of the appraisals or opinions subject to future building for PNC's own internal benefit. But all that said, PNC, as the lender, has the right to look at an appraised value and say, we have questions about whether or not the value is going to be sufficient. But that doesn't make it actionable for fraud if it exercises its discretion and
that
says...
That sounds a lot like summary judgment, not a motion to dismiss. If a plaintiff alleges a cause of action, a legal claim, and says, makes a factual assertion that the moon is made of green cheese, you don't get a dismissal by arguing the moon is not made of green cheese. That isn't right. You have to accept the fact. And doesn't this rise to the level of a fact?
Even if we accept that as a fact, Your Honor, for the appellants to meet all the elements of their claims, they have to prove that they relied to their detriment on a fact that was presented.
No, they have to allege that they relied. They say that they built the addition in reliance. They built a second floor in reliance. And now they have a house that's severely underwater on their mortgage. That sounds like reliance pleading to me.
On reliance upon opinions of future value.
But they relied on it. Whether it was initially for the bank's benefit, the Paynes are relying on that to, like Justice Mooka just said, to do the addition.
Their contention is that they relied to now. But they did.
I mean, we're not saying that they didn't do a second floor addition, right?
They did the addition. That's correct. And they allege that they relied upon appraisals that explicitly state they were for the lender's use only. And relied upon that to generate, to proceed with the work that they had done. But again, those are opinions of future value. In the first element of their fraud claim is they have to rely upon a fact. They can't rely upon opinions.
Opinions or statements as to future conduct certainly are actionable when it's part of a scheme to defraud an element, right? That's the Steinberg medical school.
Understood.
And when you're in the business of giving opinions, And if it's alleged that you gave a false opinion, you knowingly gave a false opinion, your position is that's not actionable. It could never be actionable as a matter of law.
I wouldn't accept the broad statement of never actionable.
It would have to be a broad statement if it's as a matter of law, right?
Right. Tethered to the facts alleged in this complaint, I don't think there are facts that take these allegations to an actionable claim that are set forth in the amended complaint that the appellants filed in this particular case. There isn't sufficient factual information to tie those things together.
Because when a civil plaintiff is sitting down to draft a civil complaint for fraud, they don't have the benefit of a grand jury. They don't even have the benefit of pre-suit discovery.
They had a federal case.
They did in this case, but that's correct, Your Honor. They did have some pre-suit discovery in another lawsuit. Correct.
So isn't it a little unfair? Because by definition, in a fraud case, there's a disparity of knowledge between the plaintiff and the alleged fraud feasor, right?
Understood. Correct. And I'm certainly not suggesting that a plaintiff has to allege every conceivable fact in the complaint in order to be actionable. But it is a fact-pleading state, and they have an obligation to set forth facts that rise to the legal elements necessary to pursue viable claims.
Well, help us out here, going back to Justice Mitchell's question. There is this allegation that they agreed upon minimum value in advance of the appraisals, and PNC knew the house was well below that appraised value.
That's our green cheese scenario.
Yeah,
correct.
I agree with you that the specific factual allegations don't seem to support that. So what do we do with that allegation?
Right.
What do we do with that allegation?
In my opinion, I still believe that is a conclusion.
Too conclusory to be
actionable. But even if we take that as an alleged fact, I would respectfully contend that it is still a bridge too far to extrapolate that into knowing fraud allegations. The mere fact that the bank may have had concerns...
No, it says knowing that the probable actual value was well below. Knowing, not concerns. It says PNC approved the loan knowing that the value was much lower.
That's correct. But I would respectfully contend that that ties in with the whole reason the appraisals were performed in the first place, for PNC's benefit. PNC doesn't want to make a loan that is significantly underwater. They have no interest in doing that. So even if we take the plaintiff's allegation, the fact that the bank may have looked at this and said, we're making a risky loan here, does not mean that we can draw the inference that they were intentionally trying to defraud their lenders.
Well, that's summary judgment territory. That's not a motion to dismiss. That's where they're getting into reasons of why the bank did this, or what the plaintiffs really did, and what they can actually prove.
If that were the only element for them to satisfactorily prove their claim, then I would potentially agree. But there are multiple elements in each one of their claims. They have to be able to prove that it was knowingly false. Don't believe that we have that here. That it was intended to cause them to rely to their detriment. Don't believe that that has been sufficiently pled. Proximately resulting in ultimate damages, which has maybe been conclusively pled in this instance. So just the fact that they've alleged that the bank had information that told them it was insufficient, we respectfully submit that the trial court correctly recognized it is still too much of an inferential leap to take that one fact and equate that to fraud. In addition, even if we assume for argument's sake that that was sufficient, the claim's still time-barred.
But don't you? I mean, when you're reading a complaint, a motion to dismiss, it has to be read in the light most favorable to the non-movement.
Understood.
And that means they get the benefit of the inference, not the bank.
Understood.
The defendants.
Understood.
So how do I guess that's one of the problems I have with the trial court's ruling, is it seemed to me as if that there were inferences being drawn against the plaintiff.
I believe the trial court looked at all the facts alleged in their totality, not singling out anyone, making anyone more important than the other. Recognize that all the facts...
Yeah, unless you just miss some facts. Another fact. Defendant knew that the appraised value was inflated and false. What do you do with it?
Again, I think that the contention...
Let me ask this. A hypothetical question. If two appraisals and a bank loan officer went to lunch and said, we really want to make this deal. We want to lend this, so you need to come in at this amount. And we know the house won't support that, but we want to make this loan. We're in the business of making loans. You don't make money, we don't make money unless we make loans. Let's go do it. Could that give rise to a claim of fraud?
Those facts potentially could, but it wouldn't be the appraisals that would be giving rise to that. It would be different overt acts and different communications that were made to the lenders. The fact that the bank obtained appraisals for its internal purposes that the lenders claim they rely upon isn't a sufficient factual basis to form actionable fraud. In addition to that, again, as I said, even if we assume for argument's sake that it would be, the claims are time-barred on their face.
Is there a requirement that a bank making a home mortgage loan get an appraisal?
I honestly don't know, Your Honor. I don't know if there's a requirement. I know that there are certain standards when they obtain one in terms of what they meet. I don't know if a bank is required by any legal standard. Now, there may be...
Fannie Mae or...
Yes, some of the investors, I'm sure, have regulations that require an appraisal before they will underwrite a loan, certainly. And I'm certain that, I speak for my client and most other lenders, that they have their own internal policies and procedures, that those internal policies and procedures require an appraisal from an underwriting standpoint.
You started to talk about the time bar, but Tom, the statute of limitations, let's just talk about one of the claims. Negligence is 2 years.
2 years. That's right. Correct.
And so would you say they're time barred as to the negligence claim?
Absolutely. Negligence is probably the easiest. Out of all the ones, even if we want to accept the appellant's contention of a discovery rule or fraudulent concealment, by their own contentions, they became aware of the circumstances that they claim they lacked the knowledge of in 2017.
Or even 2018.
Or early 2018. This lawsuit was filed in November of 2021. So even utilizing the discovery rule of fraudulent concealment, which is addressed in our briefs, those theories...
Or even if you take it as the federal court action.
Even the federal court action, the negligence claim is time-barred under any mechanism...
Well, let's talk about the conspiracy claims, then, or the fraud claims, which are five years.
5 years statute of limitations. There's no meaningful disagreement from the appellants that we're talking about events that happened in 2004, 2005. So on the face of the complaint, the fraud claim, conspiracy claim, time barred, absent some type of exception to the statute of limitations that would allow those claims to proceed. They have advocated for a discovery rule or fraudulent concealment contention, both of which, respectfully, they have simply failed to set forth anything to support those claims.
But as Justice Mitchell has pointed out, other than whatever limited discovery went on in federal court, they just don't have the ammo right now to support that. They're saying that was concealed from them. The structure of these appraisals was concealed from them back in 04, 05, so they just didn't know.
But as it relates to the discovery rule, they could easily allege what facts they undertook to try to determine that the appraisals were inflated. And in fact, their allegations are contradictory in their face. They've stated in their complaint and have reiterated today that the home consistently was appraised for less than the $1.4, $1.8 million. They consistently received tax appraisals in the $600,000 range, going all the way back to 2004, 2005 when the work was being done. In order for them to effectively plead a discovery rule, they would need to set forth something more than a conclusory allegation of they made good faith efforts or they made concerted efforts to try to get the additional facts. All of this information was readily available to them. This is the value of their own home. There was nothing that precluded them from obtaining information that would have allowed them to discover the allegedly fraudulent appraisals if they were. Again, putting aside that these were appraisals in 2004, and the basis for them being inflated is what the values would be now, and those are apples and oranges. But even if we assume that they were inflated, there was nothing that precluded the appellants from obtaining that, and therefore they can't rely on the discovery rule. Same result with fraudulent concealment.
You're saying under the discovery rule they had an obligation beginning when to find out what went, beginning when, according
when,
to
when the loans were made. I mean, if from the loans are made going forward,
they have no reason to.
Well, they just
the whole point of the discovery rule, right? Is that I didn't know, and I had no reason to know until some subsequent event put me on notice.
I would respectfully contend, Your Honor, that even based upon their own allegations, they had reason to know. Their own allegations are that for years they had received tax appraisals at $600,000, that they had consistently been provided with information indicating that the house was worth nowhere near what the loan was. So, respectfully, the law does not allow them to sit on their rights and say, well, we think it might be too high, but we're not going to look into this. And then 15 years later say, now we think they were way too high and it was fraudulent.
But they don't allege in their complaint, do they allege the tax?
I don't see anything about that.
So we're talking about something outside the complaint now that defeats their right to relief?
I can't recall exactly the record citation of where the tax appraisals are.
Again, it sounds like summary judgment, not a motion to dismiss.
I do believe the First Amendment complaint makes reference to the fact that the home had consistently for years been appraised at less than the appraisals.
That complaint is a nullity and it's not the operative complaint. It wasn't a verified pleading.
Right.
So
their claim simply isn't plausible in terms of being an actual claim is on the one hand they say it should have been so readily apparent to PNC and the appraisers that these were inflated that they committed fraud by not disclosing it, but at the same time was completely undiscoverable to the appellants as they entered into the loan transaction. Respectfully, there's a little bit of a tension between those two different points, and they can't have it both ways. We would also contend the fraudulent concealment arguments fail for similar reasons. Fraudulent concealment requires affirmative acts, affirmative undertakings by the defendants to prevent them from learning the information necessary to file a lawsuit. Everything that the Paynes have identified in their complaint, in their briefing, in their arguments, everything is omissions, not affirmative acts that they rely upon to invoke the fraudulent concealment doctrine. Because neither of those doctrines would apply, and we're talking about events which occurred in 2004 and 2005, we would respectfully contend that the claims are time-barred in addition to being insufficiently pled. And no amount of amendment would have changed these deficiencies. Even had, I think there's a question I meant to get back to earlier, had there been a warning, hey, we're going to dismiss this if you don't address these. The deficiencies that exist here could not have been cured. This could, the complaint could have been amended 10 times, and we still would have the same legal deficiencies that the trial court recognized supported dismissing the case with prejudice.
This might be a question better directed to your friend on the other side, but I guess I'm struggling with what the damages would be. If I was defrauded into borrowing $1 million, you gave me $1 million upon the terms that I agreed to pay it back, and now, I mean, I got $1 million, or I got whatever the sum was.
We certainly argue, Your Honor, that the complaint insufficiently pleads actual damages. And you hit on a very correct point, which is what trying to determine those damages would be.
Fluctuation is an actual damage.
That's correct. This is a renovation that occurred prior a global recession and everything else that occurred. I'm not sure if anyone could ever actually calculate what the actual damages would be from folks that have derived the benefit of being in this home for the past 15 years. That is correct. They received the loan. The loan was used for its intended purposes of making the renovations. The fact that it is now underwater, while unfortunate, does not make it actionable against any of the appellees in this case. I want to be mindful of giving my colleagues some time to address the other issues, so barring other questions, I respectfully request that the court affirm the trial court's decision, and I'll yield to Ms. Bartolucci.
Good afternoon. My name is Elizabeth Bartolucci. I'm with O'Hagan Meyer, representing Defendant Shiro, but arguing on behalf of all defendants on the substitution due process issue. May it please the court, counsel. Even if plaintiff's argument regarding the error complained of here had not been forfeited and were deemed to implicate plaintiff's due process rights, it cannot be equated with the narrow class of automatically reversible errors articulated by the Illinois Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court.
Let me ask you a question about the state of the record. Was there a docket entry in the trial court indicating that a new judge had been assigned to the case before the new judge ruled on it?
No, Your Honor. But I do know, as you did, that there was ample public record of Judge Snyder's retirement. He retired January of 2023, and Judge Snyder issued her decision March 30th of 2023. Not only that, Judge Snyder struck the hearing date in early November of 2022, so 5 months elapsed, indicating there would be a written ruling forthcoming, striking the hearing. 5 months elapsed with no written ruling coming. One could say it's incumbent upon the parties to see what's happening with their motion, but even aside from that, there were public notices, the ISBA newsletter, and the Daily Law Bulletin published news.
Is that on the record?
I don't believe that the articles themselves were put in the record, but they're capable of judicial notice. I would ask the court to take judicial notice of the fact that Judge Snyder's retirement was made public and it was effective January 2023. So there was certainly notice. It's a little disingenuous for plaintiffs to say they were blindsided when they got a decision from Judge Snyder. I mean, we've all been litigants. We've all worked at the trial level and know that, you know, litigants can contact the court at any time to find out, you know, what's happening with the ruling on their motion, but aside from that, there was public record.
I assume the answer to this is no, or the plaintiff would have mentioned it, but there's no local rule that requires notification or anything of a new judge being assigned to
not
a case.
Not that I've discovered, Your Honor. But even aside from the peculiarities of Cook County, we still have to acknowledge that this is an administrative issue. Because the forfeiture here is significant because there's not even a court order that you are being asked to review. Judge Snyder certainly can't be found to have erred in ruling on a pending motion that was transferred to her. She certainly couldn't be found to have erred in just ruling on the motion. So there's
But what is the plaintiff to do?
Right.
file a motion to vacate the judgment. They had 30 days after the dismissal order was entered to move to vacate the judgment, saying, wait, we weren't notified of the substantive reassessment.
The judge would have said, sorry, too late.
Why would it be too late?
It's a substantive ruling.
No.
You're bringing the motion after I made a substantive ruling.
Well, but the first step would be to file a motion to vacate, not the substitution motion. The first step is motion to vacate. Then, if that's denied, you have an order you can appeal. Here,
and the motion to vacate allege and say that we had not been on notice that Judge Schneider had been appointed to replace Judge Schneider.
Exactly, and we were deprived of our alleged due process right to exercise one peremptory substitution. So here, the first step would be to move to vacate, and the court could vacate on any reasonable terms and conditions. They don't have to meet even the standard of a motion to reconsider under 1203. It's just a motion to vacate based on an alleged due process violation. If that had been denied, then plaintiffs could have appealed the denial of that motion. They didn't do that. They just came straight to the appellate court. So now you are being asked to basically find an administrative clerk's error or Judge Schneider wrong for ruling on a motion that was assigned to her, neither of which are recognized in Illinois. And, I mean, even if you consider the substitution of judge as a matter of right to be a due process right, which no court has actually held, plaintiffs cite the U.S. Supreme Court in Nader multiple times, implying that the court held that. That case didn't involve a substitution of a judge at all. It just addressed when substantial rights are affected, the due process analysis and harmless error analysis that could follow.
We know that when the substitution right is violated, it isn't subject to a harmless error analysis. It's treated as an automatic reversal.
Well, but in this context,
is there an element? We've had trial judges who improperly denied motions to substitute, and then that seeds the record with a reversal of order.
Well, Your Honor, the jurisprudence that exists focuses on whether the litigant was deprived a meaningful opportunity to be heard at a meaningful time, and whether the process itself was fair. So here, and granted, there are several cases that say a litigant is entitled to an unbiased judge. Here, that's not the issue. The issue is not substitution.
Right. If you bring a timely motion to substitute judge, it's a matter of right, and the trial judge improperly denies it, every ruling entered after that is going to be void because it's going to get reversed on appeal. It's not subject to a harmless error analysis.
Right, and I mean that's where the entire due process analysis becomes apparently not relevant here, because this is not a due process right. But what you stated was the very first requirement is that the party move for substitution of judge. That didn't occur here. That is the first threshold step that has to be taken by the litigant, and that didn't happen here. I agree, if a party moves for substitution as a matter of right, that's improperly denied, any subsequent order is vacated, it goes back. But that's not what happened here. So we're now looking at an amorphous hypothetical situation that didn't occur. And the plaintiffs are asking us to make the leap that, well, if we'd known the judge had changed, we would have filed a substitution motion, regardless of who the judge was, which kind of negates any concept of prejudice, right, or bias.
There has to be a showing of bias or prejudice, right?
Agreed. So they were going to just file their motion because they felt like it. Okay, they get a new judge. But even if they had, courts talk about the ameliorative effect or the remedy that results when there are other safeguards, other procedural safeguards. So here, now the plaintiffs are getting de novo review of their complaint. And the plaintiffs, by failing to file a substitution motion, they're now saying, well, we were deprived of an important right, and that can't be remedied other than by reversing the judgment. But I just don't see a basis for reversing a judgment when a party didn't even seek the relief that would give them the right to that judgment.
So am I right in summarizing your argument as two parts? First of all, they forfeited this because they never found a way to present it to the trial court, and the way to have presented it would have been a motion to vacate. Look, Judge Schneider, you should not have done this. We didn't, so vacate your ruling. That's what you're saying they should have done, correct?
Yes.
And then you're saying even if they had done that, they don't have any due process right to be notified that the calendar has changed. Is that also your argument?
Yes. I don't see any right. I don't see
it. You have an obligation to follow your case. You should follow. That's your due process right. As long as we're not hiding the fact that the calendar has changed, there's no due process.
Exactly. Right? The entire due process here is loosely tethered to the 14th Amendment due process concerns, but a substitution of judge has never been held to be a constitutional right under the federal or Illinois Constitution. It's a legislatively created, I would say, privilege given to litigants that has been actually challenged under
federal. Well, I'm not sure I agree with that.
I'm more with
Katie. Well, whatever. We can agree that it's not.
There definitely is a due process right to have an unbiased judge.
Yes, that's a different section of the statute, though. That is definitely a right, and that is the subject of some constitutional case law from the U.S. Supreme Court and the Illinois Supreme Court. But the right to a substitution of a judge as a matter of right has never been deemed a constitutional or a fundamental right. It's never been held to implicate due process concerns. Some courts do analyze parties' arguments that they were denied due process in connection with substitution motions, but I've not found one case that says it's a due process right that a party has. So
you have a right to know who your judge is. That is probably a due process.
Well, but don't you also have an obligation to investigate that, take notice of public records?
Perhaps.
So, you know, the error here, if any, was administrative. It didn't implicate a fundamental right or a constitutionally protected right. And the fact that the plaintiffs didn't move for a substitution of judge means you don't have a basis for vacating every subsequent order. You just don't. So how will you justify vacating the order here when there was no motion made? And I know forfeiture is often a doctrine the court doesn't like to apply. They want to go to the merits, and they say it doesn't apply to us. It only applies to the litigants, which is true.
Well, I love forfeiture, but it's the other
one. Okay. Well, good. I hope you're the author. The majority in this case. So, but it's significant here because it actually implicates defendants' due process rights. They never got to address this issue in the trial court. And they
you would have had no role in it, right?
If they had failed to file a substitution motion or didn't file a substitution motion and just filed a motion to reconsider or to vacate, then yes, we would have definitely had input.
Sure.
And maybe we would have lost, but there'd be a record, there'd be arguments we could make, and we'd be prepared to address a due process issue that we knew of for the first time reading their opening brief. So I don't get the sense that you all feel all the U.S. Supreme Court case law is necessarily implicated here, but just to go over some of that quickly, if you do believe it's a due process right to have notice of your new judge and to file your substitution as a matter of right, even though the Illinois Supreme Court has not recognized that, the court should still analyze this under a harmless error analysis because of the procedural posture in which it reaches the court. I understand your point, Judge Mitchell, that nobody has to do that when it's the court agrees that the trial judge incorrectly denied a substitution as a matter of right. But that's not our posture here. So plaintiffs have put us in the posture we are in, which does require a harmless error analysis. This case, if the court were to agree with plaintiffs and presume prejudice to them, you'd be creating an entirely new category of structural error that the U.S. Supreme Court and the Illinois Supreme Court have not recognized. The structural errors in those cases, repeatedly, the courts say, relate to the framework of the litigation, not the errors in the process itself. So the framework here usually involves the representation of criminal defendants by counsel and an impartial judge. We don't have either of those issues here. This is not a structural issue, so the harmless error doctrine applies. And here, because the plaintiffs are getting de novo review, any harm that was caused by the trial court's order can be remedied on review. And because the plaintiffs have not sufficiently alleged fraud, I just want to comment on that quickly, that although there is the troubling allegation of meeting and agreeing to a minimum value, there's no who, what, where, when, why. There are none of the facts that are needed for fraud. And the delay in bringing this suit is problematic in that regard and why the limitation period should be enforced, because now we're talking about alleged conversations that occurred in 2004, 20 years ago. And the parties are implying, well, now we can do discovery. We're going to do discovery out of conversation or what, emails or some agreement that was made 20 years ago. That's why statutes of limitations exist, because this is going to be impossible to disprove based on this very conclusory allegation of some agreement among all the defendants without making any specific contentions factually of what defendant did what, who agreed to what date, no specifics.
Well, those are all things that could be cured by repleting.
Right.
But plaintiffs are very equivocal about whether they would even amend. They've had multiple opportunities to amend, and they haven't found new facts, and they haven't indicated truly a basis for the one allegation that troubles the court. So unless you have any further questions, I'll rest there.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, counsel.
So you had asked earlier if we would amend, what would we do? And what's most troubling is that we have already alleged that the bank knew at the time it gave the loan that the house didn't support $1.8 million. But if we could allege... I'm sorry.
We'll continue.
But if we could allege, I amend the complaint, we would attach those documents to show that the bank knew that at the time that there was insufficient collateral.
May I ask my damage question, Jim?
Okay.
How have your clients been harmed? Because assuming everything you say is correct on the complaint, but what's the damage to them? That is to say, they got a loan for the agreed upon amount, upon the agreed upon terms, that maybe they didn't qualify for, but that's to their benefit, not their detriment.
It's actually to their detriment, because right now, the house, they're underwater. And as to what they would do, how could we correct that? We could...
So now that means the lender becomes the insurer of the home value? That can't be.
There was a case that we cited, Your Honors, that talked about what should happen when when there is a misrepresentation. And that case is James versus Lifeline Mobile Medics. And in there, the court stated, where a misrepresentation relates to a specific extrinsic fact materially affecting the value of matters at issue, and where that fact is one of particularity within the knowledge of the speaker, and the statement is made with knowledge of its falsity, or what the law regards as the equivalent of knowledge, and is acted upon to the injury of another party, such misrepresentation amounts to fraud, warranting a court to set aside the contract induced in whole or in part thereby.
So
we're asking for reformation. I mean, some type of...
Basically a loan modification.
Right, right. Which the bank, which we've asked for, which the bank has been unwilling to do. I understand it's...
Are they going to give the money back?
No. They're not going to give the money back, but
the pains are... You borrowed the money, you had the benefit of the money, but you're going to get reformation and you don't have to pay the money back?
No. They've been paying the money back since 2004. They've been paying the money back. The issue is the house does not support the loan, and that was an issue with PNC and the appraisers. We're asking for... One remedy would be reformation. They want to pay. And how they've been damaged, you've been asking this, is because they have been in this contract. They're underwater. They don't want to walk away. Other people in this situation will walk away from the loan and just leave the house and just let the bank take over. They don't want to do that because it damages their credit and their reputation. Dr. Payne refuses to do that, although that's what other people in this situation have done. We're asking that the court look at what was done. They were lied to. The house never appraised for $1.8 million. They violated USPAP guidelines and standards. We can prove that.
But they performed additions or remodeling and invested such an amount. That's what Mrs. Mitchell is referring to. They've invested that amount,
right,
but they should not be held to pay that amount back?
Well, they have been paying it back.
But what you're asking us to do is...
But if like the court in James says that it was based on fraudulent misrepresentations about the value of the property with the addition, they're entitled to some relief. And what is that relief? We have to work that out. But right now, we're just trying to plead a cause of action. So we would ask that you allow us to do that. We can work out. Maybe the bank will agree to something. But at this point, we're saying they have been hurt. They've been lied to. We can show that they didn't comply with these standards. The standards were in place at the time. They tried to address the situation. The bank, they didn't know. And there's an issue of fact that we would argue about when they were put on notice. We've cited case law as to that issue. So we believe that is an issue of fact and not appropriate for a motion to dismiss.
Okay, you're down to your final minute, so we...
Okay, I think that's all we have. I know there was an issue about why didn't we file a motion to reconsider. As we've stated before, when we got the order dismissing the case with prejudice from a new judge, by operation of that rule, we couldn't go back to that judge because the substantive ruling had already been made. And we believe that is a fundamental right under our state that we should have a right to SLJ, and we were deprived of that. Thank you.
Thank you to both, all of our counsel, for excellent presentations. You've given us a lot to think about, and that will be taken under advisement for study and opinion. All that, we're adjourned.